Well, good afternoon, and thanks for staying. I'm a geologist, so we're going to go from the sublime to the ridiculous. Having said that, I have been conducting some experiments this week on non-Newtonian flow in pipes in my upper respiratory tract, and I'm going to try not to present you with the results of that. I should point out that Mohammed is a co-author on this work. I've done a lot of work with Eckhart's group over the years, and I'm going to draw on quite a lot of that in passing in this presentation, and also some colleagues from Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul in Brazil. The issue here is the transfer of sediment into the ocean. This is going to be almost the last picture of any rocks I will show you, despite the fact that I'm a geologist. Sediment is derived from the erosion of the continents. It's transferred by rivers to the global ocean. Most of it is resident in coastal areas for a while, but ultimately it gets transferred to the deep sea, and there's quite a lot of it, something like 20 billion tons a year, which is geological time spans, makes for quite a lot of sediment. So the deep ocean is the ultimate sink for most of the sediment that's derived from the erosion of the land surface, and its residence time in the ocean scales with the average age of oceanic lithosphere before it gets subducted and accreted onto the margins again. So you're talking about hundreds of millions of years. And this gives a thickness map of the sediments in the ocean. You can see most of it's plastered around the continental margins, but it's in thicknesses in places exceeding 10 kilometers. So we're talking about a very large quantity of sediment. Of course, when you go and look at the ocean, mostly what you see is the ocean. So it's quite difficult to evaluate the processes that are going on in the deep ocean. We're very dependent on indirect methods, on remote sensing like the swath bathymetry, and Daniel showed you some beautiful examples of that earlier in the week, and on processes like coring. Direct observations of processes in the ocean are very, very few and far between, so we're very dependent on indirect observations. The range of processes that transfer sediment into the deep sea are quite diverse, going from submarine landslides. This is an image of the seafloor offshore Brunei. It's about 100 kilometers by 100 kilometers. On all of this surface is a submarine landslide, but mostly that's transferring sediment from the upper slope to the lower slope. It's not pushing it right out onto the ocean floor. Also, a lot of ice rafted debris, material that's embedded in land-derived ice, which then floats over the ocean. That material gets released as the ice melts and ends up on the ocean floor. That happens to have been quite important over the last 3 million years or so, but geologically over long periods of time, it's not a major contributor to deep ocean sediments. Then we get pelagic settling, which includes what's called marine snow, all this fine sediment that's coming out of the water column. It's mostly biogenic in origin, so that's zooplankton, phytoplankton. As they die, they sink to the bottom, fecal pellets, and so on and so forth. But the actual accumulation rate of that kind of sediment in the deep ocean is very slow. Most of what gets transferred to the deep ocean is through these fluid-mediated transport processes. So river plumes and turbidity currents, both buoyancy-driven. The turbulence maintains the sediment in suspension, and in the case of turbidity currents, it's that suspended sediment that is giving it the negative buoyancy. Typically in river plumes, the suspended sediment actually contributes rather little to the buoyancy because the concentrations are so low. But between these two processes, that accounts for most of the sediment that gets transferred into the ocean. So what accounts for their ability, their capacity to move sediment a long way out from the continents? I'm going to talk a little bit about river plumes in that they processes in them have helped to inform us about what may be happening in the deep ocean. Here's an example of a cross-section of a river plume off the Congo River. It used to be called the Zaire River. The section's a couple of hundred kilometers long, and this is in suspended sediment concentration. And this is in grams per cubic meter, and you can see that the concentrations here are extremely low. This is the plume, and here is an underflow, which may be derived by secondary processes of settling from the plume, but even close to the river mouth, we're only up to about 100 grams per cubic meter. So this is typical of the very low concentrations of suspended sediment in most river plumes, but not all. And here we have, got a movie, of course, it's a movie tree here, isn't it? That's a buoyant plume. It's fresh water, actually not carrying very much in the way of particles, moving over a saltwater reservoir, driven by buoyancy, of course. Fresh water floats on the salt water. At some point, it detaches from the bed. That detachment point is governed by a Freud number, of course. There, turbulence is generated in the boundary layer. That turbulence decays at the detachment point. Often there's some additional turbulence here, but most of the coarse grain sediment, which is in bed load and the coarser suspended load, gets deposited here. But also, you get mixing here between the salt water and the fresh water, and if it's carrying suspended clays, they will tend to flocculate because of the ionization of salt water. So you tend to get a lot of clay suspended here. So most of the sediment actually drops out very quickly, and it's only these relatively low concentrations that get carried forward in the plume. Plumes exist on an enormous range of scales, so we have to find some way of characterizing them that's applicable equally. What are the characteristic parameters? And probably the most important one, I think, is the gradient Richardson number, which determines the stability of the stratification on the lower boundary of the plume. So it's the balance between fluid shear and the gravitational effect on the density stratification. And these are some the results of some direct numerical simulations which were done by Rolf Henniger at ETH, who was co-supervised by Eckart. The lower surface here is an isosurface of salinity, and it contrasts the two cases here, where the lower boundary is stable, and here where it's unstable, and we're starting to produce these instabilities which generate a lot of mixing. The upper surface is an isosurface of suspended sediment. You don't need to think about that. So typically, when the gradient Richardson number takes a value of greater than 0.25, the density stratification is going to be stable, and we will not get these instabilities and very much suppressed mixing and much less generation of turbulence. So here's a little simple experiment in the laboratory, illuminated by laser light sheets and usually buoyant particles. We have PIV vector maps of these, but you don't need to see that to see that this lower boundary is quite stable. We're not producing large instabilities here. Looking at the density and velocity profiles through that, there's a certain amount of noise in this, some of which is instrumental noise and some of which is turbulence. But looking at the density profile, the velocity profile approximates to an error function. The midpoints of these gradients are slightly offset from one another. We can use those profiles to calculate the gradient Richardson number, and everywhere in this plume it's well over the critical threshold. So the stratification is stable, we're not producing Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities on the lower boundary, so we've got rather suppressed mixing and not very much generation of turbulence, and that shouldn't really have come as too much of a surprise to us, because if we look at environmental measurements of the lower boundaries of plumes, we find that they are typically stable. This was actually a study that was not looking at the generation of instabilities, but on entrainment, which of course is dependent on the existence of instabilities. And we find that there's almost no entrainment of ambient fluid into this plume. And with the rather limited published data on river plumes that we've managed to glean, to calculate gradient Richardson numbers, it seems that almost everywhere, under most circumstances, except in floods close to the river mouth, those lower boundaries are probably stable. So we're not producing Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities. So you might ask, well, where does the turbulence come from that keeps all this sediment in suspension and allows these things to propagate and carry sediment so far out into the ocean? Well, it's almost certainly due to the oceanic mixing layer. If we look at density profiles, temperature profiles, salinity profiles, we see that the top few tens of meters of the ocean are typically quite well mixed. And that's because of turbulent mixing by surface waves and wind-induced shear, and that's probably where most of the turbulence is coming from that's keeping these sediments in suspension in the plumes. And incidentally, coming back to Eckhart's presentation, that background turbulence field must be superimposed on these sorts of processes, double diffusive processes that are happening at the lower plume boundary. So, onto turbidity currents. Is this helping us? Is this telling us anything about the behavior of turbidity currents in the ocean? And I want to come on to a very specific problem, which is how does sediment get transported so far out over the continental margin into oceanic basin floors over vanishingly small gradients? Here's a few examples. This is the Toyama Channel offshore Japan. Sediment's being transported all the way along here, over 1,000 kilometers, and there's sand in this fan at the end. Another example here from the Congo fan, the active channel is this one out here, and it's transporting sediment all the way out there. We see the same thing in the Amazon fan. This is the most recently active channel, well over 1,000 kilometers, something like 1,200 kilometers along the channel talweg to the sand lobe at the end. And in the case of the Bengal fan, these are those other figures at the same scale. Bengal fan, 3,500 kilometers from one end to the other. Somehow, turbidity currents are transporting sediment all that distance. How does that happen? Well, this is a moving for every part of the talk, of course. Okay, this is a turbidity current in the laboratory. It's made with crushed coal. It's a nice two-dimensional slice because it's imaged with the medical ultrasound, and you can quite nicely see the instabilities on the upper boundary, even though this is a subcritical flow, but there's still plenty of instabilities in the upper boundary. If we look at the structure that is often measured in laboratories, we find velocity profiles that look like this. This is for experiments run by Octavio Siqueiros at Urbana-Champaign, an excellent PhD study. And it shows the typical velocity profile with a velocity maximum pretty close to the bottom of the current and decaying up towards the top. And this is a schematic of that. And typically the density profile is going to look something like that. These flows are always strongly density stratified. And a very, very few measurements have been made in the environment that show similar structures. This is virtually the only measurement made in the ocean of turbidity currents by a group from the US Geological Survey of some turbidity currents that have flowed down Monterey Canyon here, which is not so far away from where we are now. And again, you see this same structure where the velocity maximum is close to the bed. And we can explain that. We have explained that as basically a logarithmic boundary layer profile, turbulent boundary layer profile that governs the inner region of the flow, what we've called the inner region. I think Juan called it the wall layer. And the upper part is, again, this shear layer profile, which approximates to an error function, and that governs the upper part of the current. And where that shear layer on the upper part of the current is dominant, then it's going to push that velocity maximum down towards the bottom. So here's a large eddy simulation in 2D of turbidity current. This was actually done by Brendan Hall, who's sitting at the back there when he was a PhD student here. And you can again see the development of these Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities. Obviously, that typical velocity profile we're seeing is time averaged. The instantaneous velocity profile is all over the place, but you can see these instabilities are extending all the way through the flow. They're involving a lot of ambient fluid into the current, but also most of the turbulence is being generated here, and consequently most of the drag. So now I'm going to step back a little bit and present some observations that we made on turbidity current channels on the ocean floor a few years ago. When we were looking at these channels on the ocean floor, we noticed a couple of things. First of all, as had been recorded by many authors, there seems to be a regular decay in the thickness of the sediment in the levator submarine channel as you go away from the channel. And you can mathematically characterize that. But we found that there were basically two different regimes. we found, first of all, that the maximum slope on the levee scales with the regional slope. So this is the regional slope, and this is the maximum gradient on the levee. What we found is that on the steeper slopes of the continental slope, steeper gradients of the continental slope, you get short, thick levees, and on the gentler gradients of the ocean floor, you get very flat, wide levees. But more than that, we found that their shapes were different. And over this threshold regional gradient of about 0.6 degrees, the decay was typically a power law, and on gentler gradients, it's typically, not always, but typically an exponential decay. And another one of Eckhart Maybach's group, Vineet Burman, came up with an explanation for that, and that is that on the higher gradients, we're getting a lot of entrainment. Basically, it's the power law decay. The entrainment rate enters into the exponent, and U sub s is the settling velocity of the particles. And on these gentler slopes, essentially an exponential decay because there is no entrainment, which rather implies that we've got no Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities being developed on these gentler gradients, and we have Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities on the steeper gradients. So, coming back to these large submarine fans, if we go and look at the distal reaches of these channels, that are feeding the sand out to the most distal parts of these fans, we can characterize the flows a little bit by, first of all, looking at the height of the levees adjacent to the channels. We know that sediment is spilling out onto these levees, so that gives us a minimum vertical length scale for the thickness of the flows. We can measure the gradients in the channels. And finally, we know the grain size. We know a little bit about the grain size of the sediments which are delivered to the mouths of these channels. So we can do some very approximate order of magnitude calculations. Here's the typical gradients of distal channel reaches on the Congo fan, the Amazon fan, and the Bengal fan. These are the grain sizes of sediments which have been cored on the lobes, the sandy lobes at the ends of those channels. And we can use that as a proxy for the shear velocity, the minimum shear velocity of the currents moving through those channels in order to transport that sediment all the way through to the mouth of the channel. We can use the approximate height of the levees in the distal parts of the channels where these gradients apply to give us a rough length scale. And we're going from 100 meter high levees in the Congo, 50 meters high in the Amazon, 30 meters high in Bengal. We've only got one velocity measurement in any one of these channels, which is published of the order of a meter per second. But it gives us some approximate constraint. Now, if we make the assumption of steady uniform flow, we can use these measured parameters to get some idea of what the density differences, the minimum density differences must be. What's the sediment loading in these currents? And the minimum values turn out to be surprisingly small. Perhaps as low as 0.1% in the Congo and down to 0.003% in the Bengal fan. Now, those have to be minimum values, of course, but it puts some constraints and bounds on it. So, now coming on to some numerical simulations, we're interested in whether it is possible, under reasonable circumstances, bearing in mind these constraints, that turbidity currents are traveling through these channels with stable stratification in the upper boundaries, which is going to reduce the drag dramatically. So you've probably heard about some of these simulations before. Continuity equation, incompressible flow. You've seen from the order of magnitude estimates of the densities that were well within the Boussinesq range. Small particle size, so neglecting inertia. Characterized by a Reynolds number where UB is the buoyancy velocity, the length scale is the thickness of the current here. Buoyancy velocity is standard formulation here, and the particle settling speed is non-dimensionalized with respect to the buoyancy velocity. And also you'll see on the slides that follow, we've specified a Froude number, standard formulation, mean velocity at the inlet, non-dimensionalized by the buoyancy velocity. Now, how relevant food numbers, bulk food numbers, are in characterizing stratified flows like this in general is I think, an open question. But we'll skip over that for now. Okay, so here's some of the simulations. I should point out that here, the settling velocity is set to zero. We'll come on to non-zero settling velocities in a minute. So what we have up at the top here is a nominal inlet food number of 0.78, subcritical. The important thing here is that the gradient is very low. The slope is 0.57%. Here we've got a higher inlet food number, and here on a 5% slope, and here again on a 5% slope with a definitely food subcritical flow. So we're contrasting what might be happening on the continental slope with what might be happening out on a submarine fan. Let me just run those simulations again. Now, you can see that there are clearly instabilities which are generated by the passage of the head. And in these higher food number, higher gradient flows, we're seeing the consistently generation of instabilities. But here, the instabilities associated with the passage of the head are decaying, and as the simulation proceeds, we can see that the upper boundary is stable on those gentler slopes. So that's just a summary of what you've got in those movies. Now, if we look at what you can get out of those simulations, perhaps the most significant thing is our profiles of the gradient Richardson number. So these are vertical profiles through the flow about halfway along the model domain. The blue line is the highest food number, the steep slope. The black dotted line is the intermediate food number, and this is the low food number on the gentler slopes. And you can quite clearly see that the gradient Richardson number exceeds the critical value of 0.25, both at the top and at the bottom of the flow, in this case on the gentler gradients. If we look at a spatial representation of the entrainment, again you can see that there's a lot of entrainment going on the steeper slopes and very little entrainment on the gentler slopes. Looking at the turbulent drag in a vertical profile, I think this is probably the most dramatic of the plots. You can see that it's almost zero in the case for the gentler gradients. The density and velocity gradients show strong contrast between the subcritical and supercritical case. The supercritical has that typical profile you expect, and the subcritical case, or more importantly, the case with the stable upper boundary stratification, shows a completely different profile, quite different from what we think of as being typical of turbidity currents. And also we see that the density profile is different. You see in the subcritical case, the case on the lower gradients, we have a steep density gradient in the upper part of the current, which is what's contributing to this high gradient Richardson number. Now, there are experiments on gravity currents, saline gravity currents, which were also published by Octavio Siqueiros, which show this anomalous velocity profile and similar density profiles to the ones we're getting from the simulations, which we can explain simply in terms of making that shear layer much thinner. It doesn't penetrate the entire current simply because we're not generating instabilities on that upper boundary. So what happens in the case of non-zero settling velocities? Well, here we look at a range from these are high to low settling velocities, non-dimensionalized with the buoyancy velocity. Again, we've got some sort of startup conditions where we've got some instabilities associated with the head, which are now propagating through the model domain, but you see we're not generating any new instabilities here. So this upper boundary is stable for these low settling velocities, whereas for the higher settling velocities, the stratification is unstable. So that may be giving us some constraints on the range of grain sizes with respect to the buoyancy velocity that we might expect these flows to be able to transport through these channels without the stratification becoming unstable, without triggering these instabilities. So, just having a look at the velocity and density profiles that come out of those simulations, again with the higher settling velocities, you see this much more conventional velocity profile. which is a result of the presence of instabilities, and with the lower settlement velocities, again, we're getting these rather different shaped velocity profiles. The same applies to the density profile. We look at the gradient Richardson number, again, the same story with the low settling velocity, very stable upper boundary. This is only incidentally the uppermost part of the current, from 0.65 of the height of the current. So there seems to be some fairly strong evidence that the stability or not of the density stratification may be absolutely critical in allowing these currents to propagate so far in the ocean. One thing that's slightly odd is that if you use this the scaling of the settling velocities to the buoyancy velocity, you can sort of back calculate what the suspended sediment loading must be, and you come up with much higher numbers than we've come up by just using the shear velocity. And so I think it's an open question as to whether the buoyancy velocity is actually the correct scale with which to scale the settling velocity. So it seems that turbidity currents on very low gradients probably have stable stratification. They don't exhibit Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities. They experience little entrainment of ambient seawater, which of course another thing that's going to lead to their, going to restrict their propagation over long distances. They've got far lower drag than flows with Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities. And of course a completely different velocity and density structure, which has some implications for what flows over the onto the levees and so on and so forth, and of course the dynamics of the currents within the channels, particularly these highly sinuous channels. But this probably accounts for their persistence over such enormous distances. But then an interesting general point here is that there is a fundamental difference then, therefore, between the way these currents behave on the steeper slopes of the continental margins and out on the basin floors. But it probably isn't the Froude number control. It's probably more to do with the stability or instability of the density stratification. So probably the gradient Richardson number is the thing that separates these two very different regimes. And I think that has huge implications for the architectures of deep marine sedimentary systems on the slope. So, let's see if this one. No sound, but that's all, folks. Thanks very much.
A very naive question, not knowing much about the subject. These things are probably not all that steady, and it's not just a steady river going always in the same channel and so forth. So there might be some deposition here, some accumulation there. And if a channel, if a gravity current comes over a previously deposited sediment, would there be a chance that there would be a larger uptake, similar to the one that I showed you yesterday in my talk, which would then also perhaps explain why it could travel long distances? In other words, it would sort of help itself over time.
Almost certainly on steep slopes, that is what happens. There seems abundant evidence that on slope channels and submarine canyons, where you have gradients of several degrees, that is happening in a big way. It seems rather unlikely to me that that's happening over the hundreds and hundreds of kilometers over which these flows travel over through these sinuous channels. They must be relatively uniform over significant reaches of those channels. In order to maintain the geometry and style of sinuosity and the character of the deposits that you see over such enormous distances. I don't know whether that answers the question. But certainly on the continental slope, on the Monterey Canyon, there's abundant evidence of enormous amounts of sediment movement and erosion in the canyon.
Just again, with the travel velocities of the order of less than a meter per second and 1,000 kilometers or 3,000 kilometers, these currents, a particle has to travel inside the current for a week or a month or something like that. Yeah,
presumably.
with the 2013 data from the Congo Canyon showed 10 days of continuous activity up in the canyon.
I'm not talking about the duration of the pulse, but
it's the transit time. Well, to some extent, it relates to the initiation mechanism. Of course, there's a huge amount of debate about exactly how many of these flows are initiated. Some of them undoubtedly are initiated by storm waves, the kinds of pressure effects that we were hearing about yesterday, destabilizing sand that's been accumulated in the heads of canyons. Some are triggered by direct river input. But however long that is, it's inevitable that the current will eventually stretch out as it moves down the current, down the channel. So the duration of the flow is to some extent going to be determined by the initiation mechanism, but also by the heterogeneity and the non-uniformity of the initiating flow. But yes, it seems inevitable that these particles must be staying in suspension for periods of days or weeks.
What role are these sinuous channels playing in all of this? I mean, that must add a huge amount of resistance to the flow. What role do they play in retarding or sustaining or whatever they do to these currents that are traveling through them?
That's a question that I simply can't answer. I'm not sure that we have the means to answer those without modeling both in the laboratory and in the
I guess people are suggesting that the vents can mix over the density structure. Could you speculate on how that would influence your results if a vent is an effective means by which to bring higher concentration parts up into the flow?
I think it entirely depends on how intense the density stratification is. And I have slight reservations about some of the physical experimental work that's been done, because I don't think the density stratification is anything like intense enough to reproduce what must be happening in this channel.
Yes. I guess this comes back to the previous question. If these particles are staying in the current for many days, and there's not much entrainment, what's providing the turbulence to keep them in that current? It seems there's, in some sense, it's saying that there's very little entrainment, although it reduces the drag on the current, would be a mechanism for explaining why these would have a very short run out, because if there's no turbulence produced by that entrainment.
It has to be boundary rock. I mean, that's the only reasonable source of turbulence. I mean, presumably a small amount will be generated by shear internally in the flow, but it has to be boundary. And I think that actually provides us with some very interesting additional numerical constraints, because we have to find a sort of parameter space in which we can suppress the instabilities on the upper boundary and yet still have unstable stratification towards the bottom of the current. And that's going to limit the parameter range, I think, quite substantially.
I was going to ask about the same question, but perhaps I can shorten it even more. The gradient is so low that there is not much, there's relatively little, on the adjacent plane, there is relatively little gravitational energy to be gained. Yet you have to produce a lot of turbulence that can only come from gravitational energy. So there is a very strong constraint, I hope. One can find a solution to that, that it hopefully goes up.
I entirely agree, and hopefully that will actually help us to limit the conditions that we have to specify for these currents in order to make the models work. And presumably that will give us some testable hypotheses when we can go out and finally measure some of the relevant flow parameters in some of these channels.
On the other hand, it means it's not, so it cannot be a situation where you have only, where these conditions are fulfilled only at one place or worse. And there are many such, so it must be something that is, even though it seems to be very constrained, it must be still be some natural solution to the problem.
Yes, and the precise parameter range is going to differ from fan to fan, of course, because of the gradients vary, the grain size of the material, and the grain size mix of material, which of course is critical to developing the density stratification and the flow of the same thickness on the same gradient, the same bulk sediment concentration with different grain size mixes is going to have quite different stratification characters.
Have you seen all the oceanographic measurements that have been made or have been trained as a function of Freed number? So there's been a big group of oceanographers. You know, you get a saline density current coming out of the Arctic and it propagates thousands of kilometres too. You don't have to worry about sediment settling out. And so there's lots of in situ measurements of entrainment measured by dissipation. And so there's some graphs showing going down to about Freed number of 0.4 and how that it sort of drops off a cliff. You get many orders of magnitude lower entrainment, so it's effectively much lower.
No, I'm not actually familiar with those.
So how do you think? So that's reasonably well established by oceanographers, but there's still a lot of debate about what the right drag coefficient is to put at the bottom of the gravity current. I mean, do you think that's well known for these large scale flows? What an appropriate drag coefficient is?
No, I don't think so.
I have a very naive question. Do these long traveling gravity currents only observed? Do you need this canyon geometry, this levees to travel very far, or do you observe also this current without noticeable transverse profile of the submarine?
Well, it's kind of movable feast, but yes, typically flows that exit channels tend to deposit their sediment rather fast. Now that depends on the grade of material that's in suspension and very largely on the size of the currents. You know, very, very big currents can actually flow over unconfined basin floors for substantial distances. And in fact, I can show you the geologists will be very familiar with this already. It's the example I showed of a turbine on the basin floor. This was actually produced by a big turbidity current in 1929. It was triggered by an earthquake. And in fact, this is pretty much unconfined. That's at 4 degrees of latitude, so 440 kilometers. So this is something like 1,400 kilometers from one end to the other. That's relatively rare. It's a very large volume flow. It contains a lot of material, something like 180 cubic kilometers. Seven. These flows, which are moving down channels on these large submarine fans, well, first of all, they've got a lot of different grain size mix, but almost certainly they have much, much lower net volumes, total volumes of sediment. And those flows are really rather inefficient unless they're confined in a pipe. Basically, as soon as they come out of the pipe, they lose their sediment quite quickly. And if you look at the scale of the sediment deposits, the sandy lobes, as they're called, at the mouths of these channels, they're very small. They're typically no more than about 10 kilometers across. So having flowed 1,000, 2,000 kilometers along these channels, then they're dumping their sediment extremely rapidly. Did that answer the question?
So these ones must have had tremendous uptake.
This particular one, that's a bit different. Yeah, that probably, that's an interesting case because it's known what the source of this was. It was sediment failures on the upper slope, which were triggered by an earthquake. And they're mostly glaciogenic silt and clay. And yet most of the deposit is actually sand. So something like 120 cubic kilometers of sand was entrained moving down the canyon on the bottom of the slope.
So it's a different mechanism than the one you showed. There was a
That's typical of what you would be expecting on the steeper slopes of the canyons and channels and the slope. This happened to be an exceptionally large current, which then continued to behave.
And the grade was pretty low too.
Yeah, the grade was very low. I wouldn't necessarily argue that this was behaving in the fashion that I argued for these channelized. float on southern clouds. In fact, I think it's unlikely.
Is there a question?
Oh, Ben, do we know what the grain size is in the depositional loads at the end of these 1,000 kilometer long channels?
A little bit, yes.
So you could use that to constrain the...
Well, that's what I did in that table to try and back out the approximate shear velocity to bracket shear velocity. There's relatively little information, but a little. Yeah. So most of the bigger submarine fans have a few cores, a little bit of core data. Surprisingly, little of it's actually out there and accessible publicly.
So just the velocity, I'm just trying to understand, you estimate the velocity by assuming the Froude numbers of order one, but then are you sort of assuming the Froude numbers much
less? No, I was estimating the shear velocity.
Oh, okay. So the meter second is based on an observation made somewhere.
Sorry, that's the one observation that we have in one of these deep sea fan channels. The sole velocity observation. So who knows if that's absolutely representative?
Well, we know that in that particular canyon, the turbidity currents at the moment are not making it into the deepest part of the system. So those currents we are sampling now are the small ones in geological history, even in that particular canyon.
And that raises a very important point, in that most big submarine fans today are either not active at all, or they're not active in the same way as they would have been during sea level low stands, which is when most of the sediment. So even if we can make oceanographic observations, if we can make observations in these channels at the present day, it's not entirely clear how representative they will be of what's been going on during the evolution of these fans over long periods of time. And these fans are typically several millions of years old.
Perhaps this is a completely stupid question, but maybe also a question related to rain. Is it completely out of question of measuring directly these currents at the end of the fans, deep sea fans? Is that something very difficult or
it's
impossible?
It's technically not impossible. The problems are, first of all, it's fantastically expensive to instrument the seafloor at these depths. I mean, the distal reaches of those channels I was describing to you are about 4,000 to 5,000 meters. The instruments are very often, they don't fare very well when turbidity currents come down, big turbidity currents come down. I mean, the literature is rife with sad tales of what's happened to people's current meters and so forth. And even the more successful measurements, usually there's bits of data missing because instruments have got destroyed or simply been transported for hundreds of meters down the channel. I think the technology is there, and with a really concerted international oceanographic effort, we could probably do quite a lot, but it wouldn't be cheap.
There is work that has been done in shallow marine environments. An ongoing problem, I think.
And the other issue is that you can rarely predict when these things are going to happen. And on, I'd say, most of the big passive continental margin submarine fans, the really big ones, they're not really doing very much at the present day. Actually, the Congo is doing some, but as Sierra said, maybe not typical of what should be happening. I don't really know entirely what's happening to the Bengal fan, the Indus fan not doing much, the Amazon fan's doing almost nothing. So, you know, we also have to be prepared to put some instrumentation down and then maybe wait several years before anything happens.
as well as also more funding for work in glacier lakes.
Well, I think on that note, we're going to call it a day. So that, I think that was the last talk. Is there any official announcement, or can we just give the organizers of the program, the conference, and the KIP stuff, and the speakers one last great applause?
Few words before everyone leaves. So this conference just closes our 3-month program, which was very fruitful. And I just would like to thank the participants of the conference as well as the participants of the program. And I wish you a safe trip back home. And see you at another program on show floors.
Thanks everybody for coming.
Yeah.
Well, the news, I think that's an event to celebrate.